it might make your postgraduate exams a bit easier if you're good at exams. But I can think of people, as I say, who at medical school went along in a fairly average way, who as doctors have really risen to the top in an incredibly impressive way.
Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the podcast from the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram. I'm the Vice President of MWF, and I have the honour and joy of being your host, as each week we hear from wonderful guests to help you feel more empowered and confident on your medical career journey. Hello, everybody. Welcome to season three of the Medical Women Podcast. Wishing you all a very happy 2023. The 1st of February 2023 marks 106 years of the Medical Women's Federation and the first birthday of the Medical Women Podcast. So just wanted to say a huge thank you to all of you who have listened, reviewed the podcast, suggested it to colleagues, and written in to send us some feedback. It's so, so lovely to hear all of your comments. I'm so glad that you're finding the podcast helpful. So thank you so much. It's one of those strange mediums because you make it and then you put it out there into the world and then you have absolutely no idea who's listening to it and what they're doing when they're listening and what their reaction is, whether they actually find it helpful. So the only way that I know that is if people write in with their comments and feedback. So it's always lovely to hear from you. So thank you so much. And if you are finding the podcast helpful, we would absolutely love it if you could rate and review it so that we can support and empower even more medical women in their careers. So in this episode, we are going to be speaking to the fabulous Professor Kate Thomas, who is Dean of Medicine at the Medical School at the University of Birmingham. And Kate taught me in my first semester as a medical student at the University of Birmingham a few years ago. And she's just somebody who has been inspiring me from the start of my medical career. And I'm sure that she will inspire you too. In this episode, we discussed what being Dean of Medicine involves, what the landscape is like at the moment with deans of medicine in all medical schools, how many women there are, how representative they are, and things that we can do to support medical students and postgraduates. And one thing that I found really helpful in this conversation was, which, you know, that's the thing that I love about these conversations. I have absolutely no idea where the conversation is going to go. But we had a wonderful conversation all about self-worth and exams and how as medics we can really link our self-worth to our achievements. So I found that really, really insightful and helpful from Kate, and I'm sure you will find that really helpful too. Just before we start the episode, a couple of public service announcements. First of all, we've got the second episode of our series with the Royal Society of Medicine on women in leadership. And our next one is on Monday, the 13th of February, and it's being organised by yours truly. And we'll be discussing inequalities, past, present, and the future. It will be really interesting. We're going to be speaking about the history of inequalities and the history of women in medicine, and then speaking about the current situation of what things are like in terms of health inequalities and what can we all do to make things better for future. So speakers include Dr. Goody Singh, and then the panel includes Professor Partha Kaur and Dr. Simon Fleming, and Professor Henrietta Bowden-Jones will be moderating and chairing the panel. So I will be speaking on the panel too. So it would be absolutely wonderful to see you all there in person. I will pop a link in the show notes so that you can register and get tickets because there's still a few left. So we would love to see you there in person. And the second event that I'd like to invite you to is our Medical Women's Federation Spring Conference, which is going to be on Friday, the 17th of March. And it'll be in London at Mary Ward House. So we've got some fantastic speakers, including some of our most popular speakers from previous podcast episodes. So we've got Susie Edwards, who's going to be speaking about career fulfillment. We've got Dr. Nikki Ramskill and Harriet Whaley-Cohen. And I'm going to be doing my first ever live podcast episode with both of them, speaking about self-worth and money mindset and everything in between. And we're also going to have a fantastic panel discussion on SAS doctors and a discussion on racism and the work of the EMRAs and what we can all do to help promote equality in our workplaces. And of course, oral presentations and poster presentations. So make sure that you get your abstracts in. And I look forward to seeing you all on the 17th of March. I hope you really enjoy this episode of the podcast and all of our upcoming episodes for season 3. If you're new to the podcast, then you're very welcome. Please do subscribe because then you'll get the episodes every week automatically. Well, welcome everybody back to the podcast, and I'm delighted today to be speaking with Professor Kate Thomas. Welcome to the podcast, Kate. It's so lovely to have you.
Thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be here.
And I know Kate very well because she taught me in my first semester as a medical student, and she's now the Dean of Medicine at the University of Birmingham Medical School. But Kate, for our listeners who don't know you, it would be lovely if you could give them a little introduction to yourself.
So I'm a GP by professional background. So I went to Birmingham Medical School as a student myself, and then I trained as a GP in North Birmingham, and then got a job part-time in a practice in Sutton Coldfield, which is just north of Birmingham. And the reason that I went for a part-time role was because I had, when I was a trainee, I had chaired the National GP Trainees Conference, and I'd got to know the people who were running the Department of General Practice at Birmingham at that time, Professor Sir Michael Drury and Dr. Robin Hull, and they had suggested to me that I might like to do some work with them. And so I decided that would be an interesting thing to do. And I got a fellowship from the Royal College of General Practitioners to undertake some research into women's attitudes towards cervical cytology. And so I started off half time in the practice and half time at the University of Birmingham doing this research project. And I did that for a year. And then the department was setting up a master's course for general practitioners, and they were looking for someone to run it. And I applied for that job and got it. And so I then started off as a lecturer in the department. And then I continued to do that for a number of years. But alongside that, we changed the curriculum in Birmingham in 1995. And there was a lot more general practice in the curriculum then. And I was part of the team that introduced that. So I then became the leader of the team that ran general practice. But alongside that, I was the person responsible for a team who provided pastoral support to students. And I did that for 18 years. And I think I was probably getting to the end of my time doing that, thinking I really need to do something different, because providing pastoral support is quite demanding. Mm. And the job as program director of the MBCHB came up. And I'd always thought, to be honest, that I wouldn't get that job because it had been the preserve of white male hospital consultants up until that point. But I did get it. And then I've been doing that for the last 7 years. Mm. And then this summer, was appointed as the Dean of Birmingham Medical School. So really feel that my career has reached its peak and now, and I'm very happy to be doing the job I'm doing. So that's a sort of potted version of my career.
Oh, that's really helpful. And congratulations, Kate, on becoming Dean of Medicine. I think you're only the second woman to be Dean of Medicine at Birmingham. But just in general, if you look around medical schools, I think the majority of deans are still men.
Yes, I am only the second woman. And my predecessor was the first woman. So it's a very recent thing, and I am the first GP to have done it. I've just been to a medical school's, well, not just, in December, went to a medical school's council meeting, which is a meeting of the deans to discuss relevant topics. And actually, I was pleasantly surprised by how many women there were there. I mean, I would say 40% maybe. Okay. Now, they may not all have been deans, because sometimes if the dean can't go to a meeting, they send a deputy.
Mm-hmm.
And they are strongly encouraged by Medical Schools Council to send a woman or somebody from an ethnic minority background as an alternative if they can't do it. So whilst I think there still are more men, I think we're starting to make some inroads, and the position looks a lot more hopeful than it did a few years ago.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to see people that sort of look like you or are similar to you in those roles, because then you think, oh, okay, that could be possible for me as well. Because as you say, it was your predecessor who was the first dean. So the whole time I was there, and before I had been there, it had all been men. So I don't think I ever even thought about any of these roles. That's also probably because I was just focusing on, you know, passing my medical school exams rather than thinking about future careers and things. But can I ask, what does the dean what does being Dean of Medicine entail? What would I imagine your day and your weeks can be quite different, but how would you describe the role?
Yes, so the role is both outward facing and inward facing. So the outward facing aspect is liaising with all the hospital trusts and general practices and hospices who take our students, and dealing with them, both thinking about the education that they offer, but also the sort of financial and organisational side of things. I work with, I'm part of the Medical Schools Council as Dean, and so that's, as I've said, an organisation where all medical schools come together, and we try and make sure that where there are policy decisions to make, we make them collectively. And so there isn't one medical school doing something radically different. And there's a lot of benefit in working together. And I think one thing that the pandemic taught us all is that actually, whereas in the past medical schools were a bit competitive with one another, we all came together to try and make sense of what we were trying to do and have some policies on students being able to attend during the pandemic and online learning. So people who had online materials pooled their resources, and we all benefited from that. So I think that has brought a big change into the role of the dean, in that we're working much more closely with other medical schools now than we used to. I'm responsible for the staff in the medical school, but I also have a colleague who works with me, who's the head of the school, who does a lot of that as well. So we share that line management responsibility. But quite a lot of people write to me about all sorts of things, people who feel strongly that they want something to go into the curriculum, people who are interested in getting involved in medical education. And just tomorrow I've got a meeting with someone from the World Trampolining Championships.
Oh, wow.
I know. The job is infinitely varied. He wants to offer some students the opportunity to shadow the doctors at the World Trampolining Championships, which next year is being held. No, this year, sorry, I'm forgetting that we're in 2023, is in Birmingham. So it can be all sorts of things. I mean, the downside is that I have a lot to do with fitness to practice for students. That's never a highlight of the job, but it's something that has to be done seriously and properly. I've continued to be the program director, so I'm still responsible for the program. And the way it works at Birmingham is that we have a head of college who is the person who deals with all the research and the research strategy and so on. So I can focus wholly on medical education.
Wow, it does sound fascinating. That sounds like a really good opportunity for the students. But yes, that I wasn't expecting you to say that you had a meeting with somebody from the World Trampolining Association. That's wonderful. And I guess, you know, with being like program director and being dean, are you able to do any clinical practice as well at the moment, or is that taken a pause at the moment?
Right. I have stopped, actually. I was in the same practice for 34 years and I stopped just before the pandemic. I didn't have some great moment of visionary prescience thinking that there was going to be a pandemic, but I was becoming busier and busier and I was doing one day a week. And what really was difficult, to be honest, was not the clinical work, but it was keeping up to date and being confident that I was really up to date with all the guidance and guidelines and that I knew exactly what was going on. As I became more senior, it became more difficult. So I decided to stop. And I had a real bereavement reaction, actually. I still miss it. And it's 3 years ago now that I stopped. But I think it was probably the right thing to do for this stage of my career. But I do miss it. I think our head of college has continued to do one clinic a week. He's a hepatologist. And I think this is slightly controversial, but I think in some ways, to be a secondary care physician, it's a bit easier to do a clinic. And if you're active in research in your area, then you naturally keep up to date. Whereas being a GP, you've got such a breadth of topics that you've got to keep up to date on. I just became very anxious that I wasn't as up to date as I felt I should be. And that anxiety wasn't good for me and it wasn't good for the patients, really.
Yeah, but I can imagine that being, you know, as you said, a bereavement reaction, because, you know, you said you'd done it for 34 years and it's a big part of your identity as well, isn't it?
Very much so. And now when people ask me what I do, I feel sad that I don't say I'm a GP first, because it is, I think being a doctor is very much part of who you are and how you construct your sense of yourself in your head. And so it does feel quite strange not to be doing it. I live just up the road from the practice, so I still meet patients when I go to the post office or the supermarket and so on. And that's really nice that they will stop and we'll have a little chat.
Do they still give you updates on their various medical conditions and things?
They used to. When I first stopped, they would tell me in great detail and say, you know, oh, do you think they're doing the right thing? And I would say, well, you know, I don't really think that I can say. But now they just tend to say I'm all right or I've had a bad time. Mm. But it's interesting that the longer it's gone on, the less they have done that. I've observed a change.
Thank you for sharing that, because I think you know, that's something that we don't really talk about, that being a doctor is such a huge part of who we are, that then when we do go through different changes in our career, it brings up so many feelings and emotions.
Absolutely. I remember being in the post office once and I had handed over a £10 note, tells you how long ago it was, in the days when we had cash, to pay for it. And the man in the post office hadn't seen it. And he said, you haven't paid. And I said, yes, I have paid. And he said, no, you haven't paid. And I said to him, I'm a doctor, I wouldn't lie about this. And I thought afterwards, what a funny thing to have said. But I thought, you know, I was so taken aback of being accused of trying to get away with cheating the system. And I think he thought I was being slightly funny about being a doctor. But I just wanted to say, you know, we're bound to be honest. And I am honest. He then found the £10 note and said, you have paid after all. So all was well. But my instant reaction was, no, you've mistaken this. I'm an honest person. I'm bound by a duty of candor.
Oh, that's so interesting that you say that, because I think whenever I've had something where there's a misunderstanding, and someone thinks that you've done something wrong, that's usually when I use that, oh, I'm a doctor line as well, because you think, oh, why would I do that? I'm a doctor. I'm really sensible and trustworthy.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really interesting that's when we use that.
Yes, I think, I mean, I often think with the medical students that being a medical student is their identity. And one of the lovely things that you see from when you see people from first year right through to fifth year is the change in their professional identity and how they take on much more sense of responsibility, and that there are certain things that as a senior medical student and as a doctor that you have to be very careful of and you have to be very open about and so on. And if we have somebody who's done well through the course and then towards the end has a hiccup with an exam or a piece of assessment, it's awful to see that sense of self as somebody who achieves and does well come crashing down. And in a way, I always say it's much easier to fail something or not to do well in the first year, because, you know, then the only way is up. Mm-hmm. And if it happens to you later on, your whole sense of self is questioned. And I think that happens when you get a complaint at work or something like that as a doctor. You suddenly think, oh my goodness, you know, am I wrong about myself? Have I got the wrong sense of who I am? Am I a trustworthy, good practitioner as I like to think I am? And I think it really rocks doctors when that sort of thing happens. And I think for a period of time, you become very defensive and you want to dot every I and cross every T even more carefully than you normally would, just because you're worried about your how good you are. It questions that at a fundamental level.
Yeah, I think you've touched on a really important point there, because I think a lot of us as medics tie up our sense of self-worth with our achievements and our performance. And I was speaking to a close friend about this recently, who's also a University of Birmingham medical graduate. We were speaking about postgraduate exams and how, you know, when it comes to, I mean, I'm sure this was the same with our undergraduate exams as well, but we link our sense of self-worth to how we do. And you've got to kind of remind yourself that actually, however I do in this exam doesn't change my worth as a human being. But I think particularly when you're at medical school, your whole life is studying and getting through the exams. Whereas as a doctor, you're a bit further on in sort of your life journey. You've kind of got other things happening as well, and you're carrying on working as a doctor. You get second chances to do those exams. Whereas when you're a medical student, it's, you know, I have to pass these exams and pass this year and get into the next year. It becomes so linked. What kind of things can we do to help medical students with that, do you think?
I think it's actually incredibly difficult to persuade them that they're not defined by those results, because obviously they do matter. I mean, it's no good saying, oh, take no notice, it doesn't matter. It does matter. I think that at the moment, the way in which foundation jobs are allocated, which involves putting students into deciles, mm-hmm. is a real negative. We really see that in the cohort, that people are obsessed by what decile they're in and how much difference this makes. And no matter how much one tries to say, look, actually, it's pretty much one question in the SJT difference. You know, if you do better in your SJT, then it will put whatever decile you're in to one side practically. But people can't help but because it's something they can control, or at least they have some control over. You know, I've worked as hard as I can, I've done the very best I can. They are able to control that, whereas the rest of their application they feel somewhat out of control with. And to the extent that last year in our welcome week, so the week before term starts for the freshers, one of my colleagues was asked on the first day, can you tell me how deciles work?
And oh, wow.
She was absolutely horrified and said, well, I can, but really you don't need to worry about that. And I think, I mean, I try and say to students, actually, all you've got to do is pass. Medicine is not a classified degree. Nobody gets a first, a 2-1, a 2-2. Nobody knows where you are. And also, there are people who are not terribly good at exams, or maybe at medical school don't put in a huge amount of effort. They put enough effort in to get by. And I've watched people who I know have had a few scrapes along the way of, you know, resitting things and so on, who have stellar careers. I mean, really outstanding careers. And I think it's really important that we try and say, this doesn't define the sort of doctor you're going to be. You know, it doesn't make you more compassionate, more caring, more efficient. It doesn't make you better as a doctor. It might make your postgraduate exams a bit easier if you're good at exams. But actually, I can think of people, as I say, who at medical school maybe just went along in a fairly average way, who as as clinicians, as doctors, are making amazing contributions and have really risen to the top in an incredibly impressive way. So I think trying to say it's not the be all and end all doesn't help, because at the time it feels like the be all and end all. And so I think saying that it's possible to get by and do well enough, but that actually it's what you do after medical school that really matters.
Oh, you put it so eloquently there. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think because we only ever see sort of the outside of everybody else's life and career, and we only ever see their successes, and we don't all, you know, go and voluntarily share where we've struggled, that then makes it harder, because we think, oh, it's just me that's like this. And as you say, I think even as a postgraduate, sometimes we have that worry that, you know, oh, if I don't do well in this exam, that means that I'm not a good doctor, whereas actually it doesn't have that correlation. So knowing that how well you do in your exams doesn't dictate how well you're going to do in your career is actually a really reassuring thing to hear, even as a doctor, and particularly for, I hope, will be reassuring for our medical student listeners. So thank you so much for sharing that.
I think it's a really important thing to know that obviously you have to pass your exams. There's no getting around that, but that it isn't a measure of your good worth as a human being.
Yep, absolutely. Oh, I could just sit and talk to you for hours, Kate. I've got some quick fire questions, if that's okay. The first one is about books, because I absolutely love reading. Although in 2023, one of my resolutions is to try not to buy so many books, because I keep buying more books than I'm getting through reading them. So I've got to finish one book before I'm allowed to buy any more. But if you could recommend one or two books that you think every doctor should read, or just anyone should read, what would they be?
Oh gosh, I'm also a voracious reader and have more books than I have bookshelves. So I have every sympathy with you. A book that I read recently that I really enjoyed is a book called The Unseen by Roy Pedersen, who is Norwegian. And my sister bought it for me, recommended by a friend of hers. And it's just a beautiful study of human beings. And there's no plot twists. There's no, you know, it's just a really gentle book about people who live on a Norwegian island and what happens to them. But as a study of human interaction, it's just lovely. And it's not one that I think you'd come across by chance. It's something that I was really glad to have recommended to me. I think another really good book for doctors to read is Elizabeth Is Missing. And I can't remember the name of the author. It's something Healy, or somebody Healy, I should say, not something Healy, which is about a woman who is developing dementia. And it gave me such an insight into what it would be like to suddenly not be able to rely on your mind when you've always been able to rely on your mind. And it's just a lovely book. I mean, it's quite sad because of the topic, but I think it's a really good one for doctors.
Thank you. They both sound like wonderful books. I will find the name of the author for the second one, and we'll put them both in the show notes. So my next quickfire question is there anything you know now that you wish you had known earlier on in your career?
I wish I'd known as a medical student that you can achieve pretty much anything if you put your mind to it. I think I I have no regrets whatsoever about doing general practice. It was the right job for me, definitely. But there were specialties that I ruled out completely because I thought I was not clever enough because I was a very average medical student. I wasn't an outstanding medical student at all. And I now realise that actually, if you really are interested in something, then you will work hard at it and you can achieve it. So my thing that I wish I'd known was that if you want something enough, just go for it.
Thank you for sharing that. And can I ask as well, because you mentioned in your introduction that initially when you were applying for one of your earlier roles, I think it was for program director, that you'd been a bit hesitant, you weren't sure that you would get it because all your predecessors had been white male hospital consultants. As time's gone on and you've done various different roles in your career, have you found that you've had fewer of those thoughts when you've been applying for roles?
Yes, I think I have got more confident. And also I'm glad to say that I think things are changing. They're slow to change, and we still don't have enough people in senior positions who represent the diversity of the medical workforce. Mm. But I think that it is getting better. And I think that there is my students would disagree with this, but I think there is less sexism and racism than there was. And the reason the students would disagree is because it's still very present. I mean, unfortunately, they encounter it on a regular basis. I mean, we still, and I can't believe this, in the 2020s, we still have female students who are told, oh, you need to do a sitting down job and things like that, which is just horrific. And people from Black and minority ethnic backgrounds who are told, well, you won't make it. You know, just horrific racism and sexism. But I think it is slightly better than it used to be. And certainly I have grown in confidence. And I think you do have to have confidence in yourself for other people to have confidence in you as well. You know, if you're always saying, oh, I don't know that I can do this, people actually believe you. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that you should become a horrible, arrogant person, but that, you know, have a good sense of what your worth is.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And it is really sad that those students are still, you know, having those experiences. And I think all of us need to work together to make sure that they don't. I think I've noticed over the course of the pandemic, and I'm sure it happened before that, but I probably wasn't as mindful or maybe didn't feel as confident speaking out, but just specialties speaking about other specialties to patients. So particularly during the pandemic, I used to notice a lot of my secondary care colleagues, you know, telling patients, oh, I know, you know, like you can't get a GP appointment, and me then quietly having a chat with them and saying, I don't think this is very helpful for the profession as a whole if we're speaking like this to patients about other colleagues, because then what you know, what sort of impression are we giving them? We're all part of one team. So I think just all of us need to be really mindful about how we speak about our colleagues.
I think that's absolutely right. It's very easy to stereotype what's going on and believe what you read in the press. And actually, GPs were working very hard during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it has had a really bad effect on general practice, the way in which they were portrayed. And it isn't good to badmouth your colleagues. It doesn't doesn't make you look better, it makes you look worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, sort of the way that we speak to medical students and junior doctors and encouraging them in whatever specialty they want to go into, rather than saying, you know, saying things about different specialties, I think is all really important as well.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
I've gone off on a tangent and now I can't remember what my next quickfire question was going to be. I think the next one I was going to ask you was, is there any advice that you've ever been given that's been really helpful that you would wish to pass on to others?
I think probably the best advice I was given to me by my first boss at the university, Professor Sir Michael Drury. And he said to me, say yes to things because you never know where they will lead you. Now, obviously, you do have to moderate that, because if you say yes to absolutely everything, you end up working yourself to a frazzle. But I think the things that I've done that I sort of thought, ooh, I'm not quite sure about this, but I'll give it a go, I've probably learned more from than the things that I thought, oh yes, I'll definitely be able to do that. Because the things that you slightly, oh, righto, I'll give, you know, I'll do my best, stretch you and you learn new things. So I think saying yes to things, even if you think, oh, I'm not quite sure I have the complete skill set. And they say, don't they, that that's a very female thing, that if there are 10 desirable characteristics for a job, a woman will only apply if she's got all 10, whereas a man with 2 or 3 will think, oh, I'm sure I could fill the rest in. And that's, again, it's a bit of a stereotype, but I think we are a bit inclined to feel that we've got to be able to do everything before we say yes. So say yes.
Absolutely. I think that's really helpful advice. And I think you've shared that before in one of the talks that you gave us when we were medical students. Quite a lot of the things that you told us definitely has stuck in my head, and I will from now and again think, oh, remember Professor Thomas saying this. so you definitely do have an impact on the students. My last question is a question that I'm borrowing from a group of children and young people that work with the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. And they came up with this question when they were interviewing people for the role of president of the college. And I thought it was a fabulous question. So they very kindly let me borrow it for the podcast. So the question is, if you were a type of biscuit, what type of biscuit would you be and why?
What a fantastic question.
Isn't it? It's brilliant.
Oh, and it's very hard to answer. You've got to think of different types of biscuit. I think I would be a Bourbon biscuit because it's chocolate. And most people like chocolate. It's got crunchy biscuit, but it's also got the cream in the middle. So it's got a bit of extra richness to it. So it combines lots of good things. And you can probably eat 2 Bourbons, but you probably couldn't eat the whole packet. So it would be good in that respect as well.
Yeah, oh, that's a lovely answer. I don't think we've had any Bourbon biscuits yet, so it's quite nice getting a new biscuit. These are dangerous questions because I then end up buying lots of books and biscuits. So maybe I need to set up some sort of Medical Women's Federation shop where we have books and biscuits for people. Oh, well, Kate, it's been absolutely fabulous having you on the podcast. Thank you so much. And is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think believing in yourself is the thing I'd like to leave people with. And have a good sense of yourself and be confident.
Thank you. That is a lovely thing to leave our listeners with. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women Podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you. And all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.